This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
Today we have with us...
Anne Weir.
Diane McConnell.
Vicky Marie Buchanan.
Alison Malden.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Now, we have among our number four teachers who went through teacher training in, what, the 1960s, 1970s?
1990s for me.
1990s.
57, 68.
70, 71, 72. Okay. So, for the three who did it earlier, were you, was that the period of bonding for teachers?
Yes, it was, and I was at Palmerston North Teachers College, and that was the last year of intake for two-year training. So that was 67.
So you go straight from school to Teachers College for two years?
No, I had...
Not you, but in general.
Yes, and a lot would have done seventh form or upper sixth. Some came straight from seventh form.
Whereas I went to university first and did my degree, and I also went to Palmerston North Teachers College, but I was an experimental year of a one-year post-degree intake for primary school teacher training.
Oh, what year was that?
That was 72.
And I went to North Shore, which doesn't exist anymore, and that was a trial training college. No exams, sort of a very free environment, and it was a three-year one, but it felt like all they'd done had just spread it out over 3 years while they waited for us to grow up.
So how were you assessed if there were no exams? Written assignments?
Very few of those even. It was lax. I loathed it.
So was it lectures or...?
Sometimes.
Classroom practice?
For instance, there was one day you'd go in for 2 hours, and those were 2 hours I was sitting in an art room making stuff. That was a day.
With much supervision, guidance?
Oh, no, not really. It was...
That's why it took 3 years, because...
Well, they just spread it out. There were lectures in there. We had more lectures on why we were professionals than on how to teach reading. Mm. So the learning all happened in the class, on section. Section was wonderful.
So was a large part of your 3 years actually in the classroom?
We must have had one section a term, three term years, probably 1 week the first year, 2 weeks the second year, and then the third week you'd get a good block each term and you'd start taking over control of the classroom and doing stuff. So was that similar to yours?
No, mine's totally different. But that's incredibly invaluable, because then fast forward into the 2000s, what happened is you got your degree and then people went to teachers' college or university by that stage, did their year and didn't really do a lot of section work, and then went into the classroom and were faced with 32 kids or 30 kids in front of them and had no behaviour management strategies and didn't know the practical workings of within a school.
Yeah. And how closely were you supervised in the classrooms then?
Well, you weren't.
For you, you just went and you were given a class.
Yeah, this is your class, there it is, see you later, good luck. But then what they did have is mentors, and I was a mentor teacher to these junior teachers coming through, junior teachers for want of a better word. So if something happened through the day with a child or with parents or just they needed a bit of support, you're there and you're in the same team or department to support them. So, and then we would have regular meetings, professional development, discussions and things like that. So that's how it worked.
Okay.
Latterly.
Okay. So in the early 70s, you were going into the classroom almost from the start as assisting a teacher, observing a teacher.
Observing, assisting, and you'd have assignments around that.
Yeah.
You know, it might be that you're looking at maths and how they're handling maths. But what you were really doing was watching how they were handling children and how they were working with difficult children or all that sort of stuff. That was where the real learning was happening.
I'd say behaviour management is probably one of the hardest things to get in control of, for want of a better word, to get under your belt. Behaviour management with such diverse students with so many needs and so many learning styles is the hardest.
And also a lot of it, I suppose, would be the sort of the individual authority of the teacher, and each person has their own way of doing that. So you've got to learn it yourself, I suppose.
You do.
And also each teacher, the way they handled their class, you sort of see stuff and you think, I wouldn't do that, or that's amazing. And you could ask them afterwards, how did you change that situation into that? And those old experienced teachers were like gold, because they wanted us to learn. They were very supportive.
But a lot of the theory about teaching, there'd be some teacher who'd be fantastic, and they think, oh, this is the way to teach other people how to teach, and you find, no, it's that person can do that, but others can't necessarily do it. So it is each has their own style. But did you find that the pupils thought, oh, this is a student teacher we can take advantage, or see how far we can push them, or were they respectful? Or
no, they're fine.
I think the culture is that the school has student teachers, and I think hopefully the classroom teacher has built that culture of respect, and so they did respect the student teacher. And if there were any that tried to wriggle around and test the system, they certainly got kazumped.
Was it special schools that I seem to think there's some normal school? Yes,
There's two ways. There was the normal schools in which every teacher was expected to have student teachers coming into their classroom, but then there were also teachers at other schools who were designated as teachers who were able to have and they got paid an extra allowance when they had a student teacher in their classroom.
So these were teachers with skills. It wasn't just any teacher.
Usually in those days, being employed at a normal school meant that you'd been identified as being a teacher with those skills and abilities to pass on to student teachers.
Now, in teaching, you're on your own with a class, but did you feel there was sort of community support among the teachers for each other with things, or were you very much on your own?
In my experience, there was sort of a group of teachers. So, for example, there'd be the teachers who were taking the Standard 2, 3 and 4. They were sort of a group. And there would be that support within the group. Sometimes there was even cross between the shared classes between the groups, so the kids weren't necessarily always sitting in the same classroom with them. Like, perhaps things like for mathematics or reading.
Did you do team teaching? Is that something that came in more recently, wasn't it? The large classes.
It was more in the 80s. We had an open plan. I was part of one of those with two really experienced open plan teachers.
Yeah.
It was brilliant because there were a team of three with enough space and a small enough cohort of children that you actually could all work together. It was excellent.
Yeah, because I've heard that.
That's interesting, because I can only talk about the young people of my brother and sister, and my sister, well, it doesn't matter who they were, but found that incredibly difficult. Too noisy, teachers saying different things, and I had one of them in tears here as school was coming up at the end of the summer holidays. I thought she loved school, and it all turned out that she was a good kid, well-behaved, bright, but with team teaching, she'd do what she thought she was being told by one teacher. Another teacher would come along and say, and she thought she'd done wrong.
Yeah. I think there's two things. Just backing up about the support, I think every school, to be fair, every school has systems that when you've got new teachers coming in, that they really, really work hard to make sure that there are senior teachers there or more experienced teachers to help them and support them. And I think from my journey, there's always been support. And I came in not having gone through Teachers College as a specialist teacher, and that was a pretty lonely experience to set up a new curriculum there. But always in a school, there's been support, and certainly up here too in Palmerston North.
Now, you said as a specialist teacher, you were...
Drama. Performing arts, coming in on that level. Yeah. And there was no curriculum at that point coming in. But then picking up, you're talking about the open learning plan, learning which became very in again in the 2000s again.
In a different format.
In a different format from what your experience was. And as time has proven, that it works for some kids, but it doesn't work for everybody. Yes. And you're right, the noise never got, that was always a bit.
So Diane, you had earlier experience that was fantastic. And then you're saying the later team teaching was different.
It came right down to the principal. The first one I had was with a principal who had made sure that the two other staff were very experienced teachers, very skilled teachers, who had training. There was training available on how to do this open plan shared teaching. We had the big room, and then we had a third room, which was the breakout room. We had low numbers, and our class didn't. The numbers were static.
There were three teachers and how many pupils?
Probably 60.
Okay. Oh, wonderful.
Wonderful. Yeah, yeah. So you could have a group of 50 doing something and you've got 10 out for special. And it was early children.
One of the things I heard with Japanese schools was that they had low pupil-teacher ratio, or they managed low pupil-teacher ratios by saying, we'll have the normal classes will be big, but where there's a problem, you can have a small group dealing with it.
Yes.
So,
and that was that. But a couple of years later, I was thrown into an open plan where all they did was took out the wall between. And it was new entrants of all things, which was was criminal. So we had 100 new entrants come through, two teachers, 60 in the room, new entrants. It was criminal. Yeah. It was so wrong. And so I've had both experiences.
So it was sort of under-resourced
too many.
Not poor planning.
Just too many new entrants. New entrants should always be a small cohort.
Because they've got to learn the basic skills.
And also you're trying to... This is where you establish whether they're going to enjoy school or not. That first day when they walk in, it has to be a safe, exciting, interesting place.
And your difficulty there, how many of you were involved with new entrants?
I was.
Two. Because I've heard some kids can go in already able to read and others can't even hold a pencil. It's so you've got such a diverse group that you've got to try and
I was talking to somebody last over the holidays actually, and she's in a school in Wellington, and she's saying some of these kiddies are coming in now that they can't even go to the toilet. They don't even know how to go to the toilet. The systems, the home environments are so neglected at the moment, and it's heartbreaking.
Would be an issue now.
What's it, sir?
Language. Languages.
So you've seen schooling change a lot since you started. What would the biggest changes be, do you think?
I think one of the biggest two stand out for me. One of them is single class into the open plan learning, which has its merits, and group work. Group work is always really, really important. The other thing that really stands out for me is the reading program, the literacy program. I think it's very, very sad now to be working with intermediate age students who are really struggling to read and understand, and they're going to secondary school next year, and they can't because the system that they were taught with this visual learning and not getting the sounding of what a sound,
the phonetic
sounds and things, and working out a word, and here to have 11 and 12 year olds.
So when you say the visual, so they see a picture and the word, and they have to get the link between the picture and the word.
It's shocking. Yeah. There are so many students that can't read, and if they can't read at 11 and 12, how can they read a problem in maths, or how can they read an instruction?
Yeah.
They can't.
Yeah. And for all of you, your experience is primary and intermediate?
Minors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Now, one thing that's often raised in terms of school is the issue of discipline and how that's changed markedly. So what was your experience of that? What was discipline? How were you told to discipline the kids at that stage?
Well, I was mainly in the standard 2, 3, 4 type era. Yeah. I don't really even actually remember any.
There were no issues. They go to the kids wanted to learn, and
I always found they did, but perhaps it was because they enjoyed my classroom. I don't know. Whether that was a factor that the kids were.
Was there a feel this is a good class, or certain schools the kids are from this background, so they'd be easier to teach or. Keener to learn, anything like that?
The schools I was at, there was quite a range of different kids from different backgrounds, so there was nothing like that. It wasn't this such a good group sort of atmosphere. Yeah. It was just the kids were there wanting to learn.
And I think also when you were a beginning teacher, those classes were chosen very carefully.
Oh, they give you the easier.
Yes, they give you a smaller cohort and a settled group. So with any luck, all you had to really focus on was
your teaching.
And any discipline problems, there was usually that, you know, your associate teacher or the principal who you could just say, I don't know what I'm doing here. They would either help or they would say, just send him to me. And it usually was a him in those days. I'm sorry. But they would, you'd sort of work together with it. But no, my first school teaching, that was in 73, and the principal pulled out the strap. There's my strap. And it was like, I'm not using that. I don't want that. But it was just seen as part of the introduction. Yeah. You know, here's your keys.
Did you make it visible in the classroom?
No. I refused to take it.
Oh, okay.
I thought I had other ways of working with children without I'd been belted when I was at school.
Yeah.
And all it made you do really was loathe the belter.
Yeah, you resent it.
I got my 8 times table, but not much else.
We'll take your arm away when they're about to come down crashing on you.
It was there was one principal, that was going back to primary school, who was a cricket wannabe, and I can still remember him doing a full wind-up bowl and bringing the strap down on the kid. It was just horrific.
Well, and so was that more for the psychology? Because, you know, flicking elastic bands, it seems horrible, but when they hit you, you don't even feel it.
Yeah, no, it hurt. It did the full wrap around. It was mean. Ooh. It was just a vicious, nasty person
loose in
a classroom. But so the punishment, the kids, back when I started, I wasn't aware, I had 20 years teaching, and I wasn't aware of many social problems with that group that I certainly was aware of 20 years later. The social problems were much.
So it's the backgrounds they're bringing into the school that make it hard.
Yeah, and the preparation for school, the attitudes to school, the attitudes to authority. I saw that change. One of the biggest changes I saw, I always thought developmental for 5, 6-year-olds, a morning where they just experimented with stuff, and then you went and talked and built language. That, to me, was the most valuable part of the classroom. Definitely. That's where you were introducing all the skills for reading and everything. A one-hour session of poorly taught reading to a child who can't do it is a waste of an hour. But a one-hour session where a child is in there and involved and making and doing and talking, invaluable. And I don't know how much of that still goes on.
No. Sadly.
And to me, that is where the real learning was happening for your very young children. That's social skills.
Yeah.
All of that's happening there.
And that's a lot of that has stopped because of the packed curriculum. They haven't got time to do some of it. A lot of it is because of the open plan learning, that it's all masses to do it. There's all sorts of different reasons. Picking up your topic about behaviour management and issues. I came into teaching in 1998 and I was dealing with drama in education and bringing drama into the curriculum. So I experienced a lot of social issues that came out to the point that I actually did a thesis on it. And it was because really through drama came out all sorts of social issues that the children were having, and it was in a private school, so there weren't the socioeconomic reasons. It was more that they were fashioning themselves on a pop star at the time that was doing a lot of singing about suicide, so I uncovered a can of worms there. There were a lot of parents were working, which we're getting now too, that parents are out there working and kids are in daycares and schools, and so the kids didn't have time with their parents, so they were lashing out and adjusting to that. A lot of it was social issues that the kids were finding too in the families. And so through the drama, all these things came to the surface. And I remember going into the principal in the first 2 months and saying, I'm not a drama therapist, this is drama. And they were great, they were really, really good and got counsellors and all sorts of into the school. But through the children and through the drama, all these sorts of social issues that you didn't even think about actually came to the surface. So
kids feel. Because now there's all the social media stuff that's affecting kids
now,
and the after-school care because parents are at work and so on. So a very different environment.
Social media, I think, nowadays, 2024, 2025, is a huge challenge for families and students. And I think that's been coming through in the 2020s, actually.
Yeah.
That there's a lot of digital.
Well, there's the book, The Anxious Generation, that's looking at those impacts since basically 2010 onwards
with the smartphones. I'd agree with that.
And that can be, I suppose, distracting. Well, you wouldn't know, but distracting in the classroom because of kids sitting there texting on their phone if they can do it without even looking.
At the schools that I've been at, students don't have cell phones in the class, never have.
Yeah.
So it hasn't been an issue. They put them in the morning and they pick them up at 3 o'clock. Oh. So that was never an issue. It was after hours.
Yeah.
It was all done after hours. But the effect of that came into the classroom the next day.
Did you find that the social skills of students declined as social media expanded?
Yes, definitely. Communication. And they text each other in their own homes.
Yeah.
If mum's in the kitchen and they're in the bedroom, they text each other. Yeah.
So how did you see that show up in their social skills?
What Diane's talking about is oral language and sitting and talking. They are limited with their conversation skills today in the classroom. I'd make that statement quite boldly now. And then if there were new students coming in or you were talking, say, oh, have a little talk about that. In my last year, was introducing oral language as a formal subject in the morning because they could not have a conversation. And when we did basic things like how are you today or give me some information, two facts, and then the students would have to repeat that back to the class about two facts they'd learned about their mate, they'd say, oh, it was really hard, you had to really listen. And that was oral language.
And it's not asynchronous. You got to do it at the same time.
It's also it's the one thing they will use for the rest of their lives.
Well, spelling as well, because you got the spelling in texts and quite different for written documents.
And talking to the reading specialist at the school I'm involved with at the moment, she said we are, as a society, we're not talking when we go home and sit around the dinner table and talk about your day. There's not the talking, so there's not the vocabulary.
You said sit around the dinner table. Does that happen much?
No, they don't. They sit on the couch with dinner on, if they get a dinner, with dinner on their lap. And so there's not that oral talking, or they're texting. They see that there it is again, and so therefore words, reading, the next step from talking is reading, making sounds. She said students now generally are 2 years behind before they even enter school.
Yeah, and the other issue that I mentioned is attention span, because there's so much short package stuff? Is that something you've observed?
No. In my, I don't know about you ladies, but in my training they always said you've got the attention span is age plus 2 minutes. And that's about
and that's not changed, really.
For me, it didn't. 5-year-old, you've got to change your activity. You've sort of every 7 minutes and that sort of thing.
Okay. And also, I was out before 2000, so I was out before the impact of this.
Oh, all the strong stuff, Because I'm thinking more, you go back 40, 50 years and young people are used to reading books. Now you read a page online or something and move on to flick on something, or you watch YouTube clips at 2 or 3 minutes and you think, oh, that's 7 minutes long, that's too long.
I think in the classes that I had, they were very diverse. And so you always had to have a diverse program, knowing that you've got oral students, you've got visual students, you've got students that have got diverse needs as well, so neurodiverse.
An ethnic mix would be included. That would have had a big impact.
Well, students that literally 3 weeks ago were sitting in a refugee camp coming into your classroom.
Without a knowledge of English or with some basic English?
No English. And so they're
How quickly did they pick up the language? Within 3 months or so?
A year.
Really? Because I've seen kids, if they're exposed, if they've got immersion with friends who speak the same language, they can often learn the language quicker than their parents can.
They do, but 3 months is a bit of a stretch.
Different.
English is a hard language.
Yeah, for study, for play, probably they'd learn all the words they need.
ESOL, I think ESOL teachers are wonderful, and they would always go out to ESOL classes for about 45 minutes an hour a day.
Yeah.
And that helped, and then we would have little programs that we could help, and in groups and.
Yeah. And they'd fit in well. I suppose if you've got a large group, they'd just stick together. And with smaller ones, they'd mix with the other kids a lot more.
I was pretty hot on trying to get them mixing in. And again, that's all the culture in the classroom. I think that's really, really important, the respect.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, there's been massive changes over the past 50 or so years.
Huge.
Thank you for listening to Manuatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.